So real quick, this is session number 131, titled William Smith and the Notorious Hodges Brothers Criminal Gang at Nauvoo. When Sunstone asked if I wanted to chair a panel, I said, yes, this one. So I'm happy to be here. Also, the book sales, if you haven't checked out the bookstore downstairs, please do. I know this book that they are speaking about is available down there, as well as many others. And so now let's get into it. Our speakers today, H. Michael Marquardt, is an independent historian, published in Journal of Pastoral Practice, Restoration, Sunstone, Journal of Mormon History, John Wetmore, Historical Association, and Dialogue. Also, Bill Shepherd, author with Mike of Lost Apostle, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Original Quorum of the Twelve. And then Linda King Newell, an independent writer, editor, researcher, and probably best known for her work, Mormon Enigma, Mormon Emma Hale Smith. So it's my pleasure to introduce them and to hear what they have to say. Thank you. Also, if you did not get a handout, I have a few more handouts for their presentation. Please raise your hand.
In our research for Lost Apostles, we encountered a great deal of information not commonly known in the Mormon historical community. This paper, however, will address elements of William Smith's final descent at Nauvoo and his relationship with the notorious Hodges brothers in 1845.
The Hodges family, on the surface, was like hundreds of early families who accepted the restored gospel. They were converted in Erie County, Pennsylvania, and as would be expected by the male members of the family, they did missionary work, and at Kirkland, Ohio, the family unitedly supported Joseph Smith. Like so many others, they suffered terribly from the forced exodus from northern Missouri. Curtis Hodges Sr. was even wounded in the Battle of Crooked River, and their statements for redress bitterly attacked Governor Boggs and his forces. It was at Nauvoo, Illinois, that the male members, all Mormons, became identified with the criminal element. William Smith's actions will be documented from the time he returned to Nauvoo in May 1845 until he slipped out at night 4 months later in September. His interaction with Brigham Young and others of the hierarchy will be presented. It seems impossible for William to have made worse decisions and commit more provocative acts than he did in this short period. As Paul Edwards famously said, he was a wart on an ecclesiastical tree.
Curtis Hodges Sr., with his wife Lucy Clark, had roots in Vermont and New York, and like countless other settlers, made their way westward. It was at their home in Girard Village in Erie County, Pennsylvania, they learned of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon from an unknown source. Scanty information indicates Curtis and Lucy visited Kirtland, Ohio in November 1832, where they were baptized, and Curtis evidently became an elder at his baptism. The Kirtland Council Minute Book, under date of December 18, 1832, noted Elder Hodges testified at the Council of Elders his determination to proclaim the gospel, and he had sufficiently provided for his family. He probably missionized in the Erie County, Pennsylvania area. There is a record of Curtis Hodges Jr. baptizing seven persons in December and in mid-February 1834, proselyted with William Smith in the Taylor Settlement in Erie County. William joined his brother Hiram on a three-week mission to Erie County, Pennsylvania in November-December 1832, during which time they baptized 23 people. It must have been on this trip that he met his future wife, Caroline Amanda Grant, in Elk Creek Township, in the far northwest corner of the state, 65 miles from Kirtland. She was a sister of Jedediah Grant. Before the Missouri Troubles, William Smith, John Boynton, Evan Green, and others established small churches in Erie County. On Sunday, February 3, at a Springfield, Pennsylvania service, William spake in tongues with much power and was joined by Amos Hodges 2 weeks later. William's thoughts turned to the courting after meeting Caroline Grant. He married her on Valentine's Day, February 14, 1833. and then traveled to Kirtland for a honeymoon. Although because of a shortage of funds, they were compelled to live temporarily with William's parents. They enjoyed associating with other believers for a time in an environment where Mormons were considered normal and were nearly as numerous as the non-Mormons. On June 21, William was ordained a high priest by Sidney Rigdon. William would reconnect with the Hodges family at Nauvoo in 1845. The Hodges were living at Painesville, Ohio in 1834, and testimony by a brother Hodge on June 3, 1833, contributed to the second excommunication of Dr. Philaster Hulbert. Curtis Sr., Amos, Sarah, and her husband Truman Waite testified against Hulbert in a civil trial in January 1834. Curtis Sr. was called before the Kirtland High Council in February to answer charges which alleged he spoke so loud and illegible during services it was, quote, calculated to injury to the cause of God, and that when he was speaking loudly, quote, neighbors came to see if someone was not hurt, unquote. Amos participated in Zion's camp.
William Smith participated in mainstream Mormonism at Kirkland. He also participated in Zion's camp, walked 800 miles to Clay County, Missouri, along with other militiamen. He contracted cholera, but survived. In the behind-the-scenes negotiations of choosing the 12 apostles, Joseph Smith rejected at least one nomination, Phineas Young, Brigham Young's brother, in favor of his own brother, William. Oliver Cowdery wrote to Brigham Young in February 1848, at the time the 12 were chosen in Kirkland, and I must say before, it had been manifest that Brother Phineas was entitled to occupy the station as one of that number. But owing to Brother Joseph's urgent request at the time, Brother David, that's Whitmer, and myself yielded to his wishes and consented for William to be selected, contrary to our feelings and judgment, and to our deep mortification ever since. About two decades later, in 1854, Phineas spoke to a group of church leaders in Salt Lake City about how his call to the quorum had been canceled. According to Wilford Woodruff, Phineas Young said that he was the first that was chosen in the organization of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. But Joseph said he wished I would let William Smith have that place, so I gave it to him. Some 50 years later, after the formation of the Quorum, in an interview by Zenas H. Gurley, conducted with David Whitmer in January 1885, Whitmer collaborated with Cotter's and Young's recollections and confirmed that Phineas was the man who was originally selected for the position. William was ordained an apostle on February 15, 1835, and accompanied the other 11 apostles on their first mission.
Curtis Sr. and Amos respectively owned 120 acres and 40 acres in Clay County, Missouri. Curtis Sr. claimed a loss of $200 when he was driven from Clay County. Curtis Sr., Curtis Jr., and an unidentified brother participated in the Battle of Crooked River on October 25, 1838, when Apostle David Patton, Gideon Carter, and a non-Mormon guide were killed. Curtis Sr. was found leaning against a tree, pale and bleeding from a wound in his side, but survived. The family suffered greatly from exposure and hunger during the forced trek to Quincy, Illinois. Curtis Sr. said the wound left him a cripple. The Hodges family's losses were documented in the scroll petition. Curtis Jr.'s wife and three-month-old child died in Quincy in mid-39 due to the privations of their march.
The first sign of cracks within the quorum itself appeared on October 29, 1835. beginning with an argument between Joseph and William Smith that left the other apostles shocked at Joseph's patience with his brother's insubordination. Their revulsion quickly turned to expressions of dissatisfaction over nepotism, especially considering how harsh Joseph had reacted to the minor missteps of Hyde and William McClellan compared to William's misbehavior. The outburst occurred during the church trial of David Elliott and his wife, who had allegedly beaten their 15-year-old daughter. Joseph and William disagreed about this, and tempers on both sides escalated into insults, after which William refused to apologize. 2 days later, he insulted Joseph again, then returned his minister's license in an act of further defiance. In December, Joseph Smith attended a debate at William's home, where he became entangled in an either greater altercation with his brother William, who physically assaulted him and some others, including Jared Carter. 2 days later, William begged for forgiveness, writing to Joseph, "Do not cast me off for what I have done, but strive to save me in the church as a member. I do repent of what I have done to you and ask your forgiveness." He had been called to an account by the 12, he wrote, and had offered to resign for the disgrace he had brought before that quorum. Joseph's injuries were apparently substantial. On December 18th, he accused William of attacking him while he was removing his coat, having once fallen into the hands of a mob and being wounded in my side, and now in the hands of a brother, my side gave way. And after having been rescued from your grasp, I left your house. He said that for a time he was not able to sit down or rise without help, but through the blessings of God, I am now better. The next month, Joseph reported that William saw the heavens open and the Lord's host protecting the Lord's anointed. In February 1836, William got into trouble again when he lost his temper with the Hebrew teacher Joshua Sextus. At a conference in May 1839, the escaped prisoner Joseph Smith announced that William Smith and fellow apostle Orson Hyde would have to appear at the next general conference of the church to give an account of their conduct, until which they were suspended from office and William was restored to his apostleship. That William was not in full harmony with his quorum was nevertheless evident by the fact that he was still in Illinois and they were in England. He apologized for his negligence in 1840 in the Times and Seasons, saying it was because of my improvised situation, which had rendered it necessary for me to use every exertion to support my family. He hoped to still lift up my voice on the shores of Europe or wherever the Lord may direct.
Some background. Hancock County, 1841, 1839, 1846. It was a violent place on the frontier. Across the river, you were in the territories. For example, Presbyterian minister Elijah P. Lovejoy's printing presses were destroyed 3 times at St. Louis, Missouri. But when another press was destroyed on November 7, 1837, at Alton, Illinois, he was murdered by a pro-slavery mob. With the advent of the 1840s, violence in rural and frontier Illinois took place with frightening regularity. For example, Judge Thomas Ford, during his tenure in Ogle County, Illinois, in 1841, was rumored to have encouraged vigilantes to wipe out the murdering Driscoll gang, which he could not do legally. Some were shot by a firing squad. Another violent vigilante action took place 10 miles below Dubuque, Iowa territory at Belleville in 1840 when the William W. Brown gang, accused of rape, stealing, and murder, was shattered when Brown and 7 other persons died in a long and savage gun battle. Regional violence was sometimes expressly targeted against the Negro population. Thomas Gregg, in the Warsaw Message under the heading of Horrid, Horrid, told about the torturous death of Nate at Dubuque, Iowa, who was lashed over 300 times on his bare back. He was apparently wrongly accused of stealing clothes. A similar event took place at Nauvoo in early 1844 when an African-American man known only as Chisholm was savagely lashed by non-Mormons. But the Mormon intervention probably saved his life. Historian Philip D. Jordan added, quote, "In the 1840s, counterfeiters, horse thieves, stage robbers, and murderers plagued western Illinois and eastern Iowa. Singularly and in well-organized bands, desperados disrupted the peace not only in the immediate vicinity of Nauvoo, but also in the trans-Mississippi towns of Fort Madison, Monroe, Burlington, and Davenport in Iowa Territory." Mormon historian Truman G. Matson specified as the largest city in Illinois, the disreputable population included counterfeiters, blacklegs, bootleggers, gamblers, and even slave traders. An element of this lawless population included a few Mormon and non-Mormons who used the Nauvoo waterfront as a base of operations. Chief among the thieves were four Mormon brothers named Hodges, who had known William Smith since encounters in Erie County, Pennsylvania. William and Stephen would be hanged for murder. Irving would be murdered in Nauvoo. And Amos, president of the 13th Quorum of 70, was believed murdered in or near Nauvoo. The relationship between the sociopathic brothers and William Smith at Nauvoo falls in the rest of our paper. There was a great deal of stealing at Nauvoo, the times and seasons, especially in 39 through 40, 41, says, "Nauvooians to the rescues, there are thieves in the midst. They are stealing your property. The church must be purged."
William and Stephen Hodges and their brother-in-law, Truman Waite and Darius Campbell, were accused of horse stealing in Iowa in October 1842. Stephen was convicted. A Nauvoo conference excommunicated Curtis Hodges Jr. for bigamy in April 1843. Curtis Sr. was accused of fleecing the saints while on a mission to the southern states in May 1844. Irvine and Stephen were accused of robbing a man named Smith in Iowa in 1844 or early 1845. Amos and his wife Lydia lived in a secluded house by the Mississippi River. William Hodges could not enter Iowa because of a previous robbery. John Taylor said he had a poor character for unrighteousness. May 10, 1845, the John Miller home in the tiny village of West Point in Lee County, Iowa, was targeted for robbery, and it was rumored that he had $1,000. They were Mennonites. 25-year-old William Hodges, 23-year-old Stephen Hodges, 21-year-old Thomas Brown, and 36-year-old Artemis Johnson, all Mormons with criminal backgrounds, slipped into the house after dark. During a siege, John Miller died when a Bowie knife pierced his heart, and his son-in-law, Henry Lisi, was mortally wounded. William left a distinctive hat at the crime scene when the criminals fled back to Nauvoo. May 11th, Artemis Johnson and Thomas Brown fled for parts unknown, but William and Stephen brazenly asked Brigham Young what they should do. When he told them to turn themselves in over to the law, they threatened his life. They then went to Amos and Lydia's house. May 12th, infuriated Iowans learned Stephen was seen with bloody clothes, and William was not wearing his unique hat. They told this to Steve Markham, and with Brigham Young's blessing, the Nauvoo police joined with the Iowans to surround Amos's house about midnight. May 13th, the heavily armed brothers refused for hours to surrender until dawn. They were held under arrest in the Nauvoo Mansion House. May 15th, Iowa lawmen returned to Nauvoo with an indictment for their arrest, and the Mormons willingly released them. Ironically, the brothers were given the choice of Carthage Jail or Iowa. They chose Iowa. The brothers were initially housed in the Iowa Penitentiary at Fort Madison. After being identified by Mrs. Miller, the dying Henry Vesey, a change of venue designated Burlington, Iowa, as their place for trial. On May 21st, the Nauvoo neighbor proclaimed the brothers had never been Mormons.
William returned to Nauvoo with his dying wife, Caroline, on May 4th, 1845. Our boarder at Emma Smith's house, school teacher James Monroe, wrote in his diary about William's arrival with his wife, who was very sick indeed with dropsy, that William, too, had the chills and fever. They came to our house to live for the present. Brigham Young welcomed them with favorable comments from the stand. Remember, Brother William, he has a sick family. Father Smith was alive with sons, and all are gone but Brother William Smith. Be kind to him. The following day, May 5, William met with six of the apostles at Brigham's house and said he was, quote, satisfied with the present organization of the church and state of things at Nauvoo, unquote. William's wife died early in the evening of May 22. The next day, as preparations for Caroline's funeral were being made, Joseph Smith's former secretary, William Clayton, wrote that William was coming out in opposition to the 12 and in favor of George J. Adams. William was claiming to have sealed some women to men and was not accountable to Brigham nor the 12 nor to anyone else. Clayton worried that there is more danger from William than any other source, and I fear his course will bring us much trouble.
On May 24th, after Caroline Smith was buried at 10 a.m., absent her husband, William Smith said he was afraid of Gentile enemies. He was safe enough to walk outside as far as John Taylor's house. He had been invited there by Brigham Young, so the 12 should ordain him a patriarch to the whole church. This was evidently considered appropriate and necessary means of dampening William's flaring hostility. The specific level of authority promised the aspirant was not recorded, but William seemed satisfied with it, and good feelings prevailed. George A. Smith recorded that the brethren present expressed their feelings toward William, to which he responded with uplifted hands to heaven and expressed the same. Willard Richards kept the minutes. Sister Young came in, he wrote, and brought a bottle of wine from Sister Clark. The present gave a toast, and all responded. William Smith asked the views of the council about his patriarchal office. President Young said it was his right. William Smith received his patriarchal blessing by President Young. According to Willard Richards, William Smith was ordained patriarch to the whole Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and to reside over the patriarchs. All the 12 present laying their hands upon him, except Willard Richards, who wrote the blessing. There was a warm interchange of good feelings between William and the quorum. Smith immediately set about integrating himself into the ruling elite, and was determined to fulfill the role his brother Hiram had as patriarch over the church. He reasoned, inheriting Hiram's patriarchal authority and adding to that with his apostleship, his authority would be superior to the other apostles. Brigham Young, however, had fought the succession fight and was the entrenched leader. He was too savvy to make the unprincipled claimant his superior. Young felt the need to clarify in a sermon that Hiram Smith although he was older than Joseph, had no right to the presidency. It was one more rhetorical roadblock to head off William's possible ambitions.
June 11, 1845. William and Stephen Hodges were removed to Burlington and changed to await their trial. An affidavit for continuance on account of the absence of material witnesses was sworn before the district judge of Des Moines County to delay the trial so additional witnesses could testify that brothers were at Nauvoo on the night of June 12. The list, presumably drawn up by their lawyer, ex-Mormon apostle Lyman E. Johnson, included what turned out to be criminal associates of the Hodges brothers. John and Aaron Long and Judge Fox were notorious criminals. It was common to pack trials with members who would testify for you, obviously. June 16. Now, the indenture, if you'll look on the back of your... It's really important because it shows that Lyman Johnson, the ex-apostle, draws this up, and he draws it up with Mormon hard cases, Return, Jackson Redden, and Bill Hickman, who were actually members of the Hodges gang. It lists a couple of Gentile thieves. Some of these are going to be hanged later on. But it also... I'll go ahead and read. An indenture drawn up by Lyman Johnson transferred land valued $1,000 to be transferred to highly respected attorneys to defend William and Stephen Hodges. As would be expected, Irving and Amos Hodges participated. William Bill Hickman, known then as a talented thief, and Return Jackson Redden also put up property. Redden would murder Irving the following month. Surprisingly, W. Jenkins Salisbury, William Smith's brother-in-law, presumably as a surrogate for William, joined in the endeavor. After participating was two non-Mormon thieves who were in league with the Mormon thieves, William Luter and Robert Birch. The jury was impaneled on June 19th, and the decision was rendered on the 23rd. The trial began with Miller's neighbors testifying the Hodge brothers were seen in the area on June 10th asking about the Mennonites and confirming it was William Hodges had at the scene. Other testimony included that Elbridge Tufts, a Nauvoo policeman who participated in the brothers' arrest, Eliza Jane Hodges, swore her brothers were at Nauvoo on the night of the murder, and her sister Emmeline said the cap found at Miller's could not be William's because she had burned it the previous February. The jury discounted the defense witnesses. Testimony later given in the trial of William and Stephen indicated there was a conduct among the Hodges and their Mormon and non-Mormon criminal associates which mandated they were required to do all in their power to obtain the release of any incarcerated associates and the pledge to kill any gang member who revealed their secrets. Strangely, Amos's wife Lydia told the brothers' lawyers not to call her to testify because the brothers were gone all that night of the murder. June 21st. During the trial, witnesses testified that Amos Hodges teamed with Gentile thieves Robert H. Birch and Judge Fox to plan the robbery of a Nauvoo merchant named Rufus Beach. For unknown reasons, Amos informed Brigham Young of the planned robbery, and Young informed Beach, who placed armed guards in the store. Birch and Fox were shot at, but escaped. Unsurprisingly, William and Stephen were found guilty and were sentenced to be hanged at Nauvoo on July 15th. Two things are taken care of. Place the brothers, William and Stephen, the trial, and another brother, Amos, in Nauvoo. After the verdict, Irving proclaimed that if Brigham Young did not help him get his brothers out of jail, he would publicly disclose all he knew of the Mormons' dealing. Amos, for reasons not understood, was arrested by the Nauvoo police. John Taylor said on June 21, a man of the name of Amos Hodge was taken up on a charge of theft. I am afraid he is connected with a gang of villains that are lurking about, stealing on our credit. June 22, Irving confronted Brigham Young at his home and threatened to take his life after Young refused to help secure the release of his brothers. Shortly thereafter, he had an altercation with policeman Elbridge Tufts for acting against his brothers in Burlington.
Associate editor William Phelps responded to William Smith's prior article saying being patriarch made him a father over the church. Taking this to heart, William began telling recipients of blessings that he was the highest authority in the Church of God on earth. If Phelps meant that the patriarchal office was more advisory and ceremonial than administrative, it was lost on William. The other apostles sought several ways in performing the delicate dance that were involved with William, in which it took the other way to modify his demands, even indulging his interest in a 15-year-old girl, Mary Jane Rollins. As a widower, William was free to remarry and apparently saw no harm in publicly uniting with a young teenager, despite the fact that he was 34. Brigham Young performed his marriage on June 22nd. Caroline Smith had been dead exactly a month. The patriarch's old enemy, Thomas Sharp, heard about the marriage and wrote that Patriarch Bill Smith, brother of the prophet, whose wife died about 4 weeks since, was again married on Sunday last. Having been a widower about 18 days, his bride is about 16 and he is 35. Bill will do well for a father in the church, but his wife won't for a mother. Wonder if Bill was not engaged before his former wife died. The printed notice of the marriage was inconspicuous for the amount of attention it attracted. Married in this city on Sunday, the 22nd incident by Elder Brigham Young. Elder William Smith to Miss Mary Jane Rollins. Of course, what the paper reported was only half the story, because William by this time was acquiring additional wives as well, three of whom he gave patriarchal blessings to.
June 23. Irving was cutting through a cornfield near Young's house about 10 p.m. when policemen Alan Stout and John Scott heard a few blows struck as if someone was beating an ox with a club, which was followed by shrieks. Irving, who was horribly mangled by bowie knife cuts and battered by blows to his head, managed to climb over Young's fence and collapsed near the door. When Scott asked who stabbed him, Irving said they were men whom he thought to be his friends from the river. He next told a non-Mormon by the name of Clapp he could not tell who assaulted him and died. Irving had no reason not to disclose the identity of his murderer other than to protect family members from retaliation. June 24, William Huntington, the Nauvoo sexton, wrote that Irving was murdered by some ruffians, as Hodges was supposed to be of the same gang. The Territorial Gazette and Advertiser of Burlington, Iowa, concluded on June 28, quote, "The assumption of many is that he was murdered by a gang of scoundrels to which he and his brothers are supposed to have belonged, to prevent disclosures which it is feared the execution of William and Stephen might provoke," unquote. Reverend Milton Kimball of nearby Augusta, Illinois, wrote his brother on August 25, "Irving was killed after threatening to expose the big line of thieving operations." On July 3rd, the Sangamon Journal said Irving planned to turn state's evidence and expose the gang of thieves, robbers, and so forth at Nauvoo. This supposition was supported by attorney D.F. Miller of Lee County, who wrote to trial judge Charles Mason on July 23. Irving was killed unquestionably by one of the band because he threatened exposure.
In an act of that defied logic, William Smith beat up policeman Eldridge Tubbs when he would not release Amos Hodges from custody and then secure his release by giving bail. It is recorded in John Taylor's journal, William Smith has given bail for another brother of the Hodges who was in custody for robbing and also beat Brother Tufts shamefully yesterday for a small offense. Amos mysteriously disappeared and was never seen again. William said members of the Nauvoo police smuggled him out of Nauvoo to Iowa and there killed him. A Universalist minister named Gurley, who was attending the Territorial Convention of Universalists in Burlington, said a fourth brother who was taken up for the same offense, but who afterwards was bailed out of prison, mysteriously disappeared. And the general belief is the Mormons murdered him also to prevent a full revelation of their dark deeds. A logical conclusion is Amos was murdered by his gang members he betrayed in the failed robbery at Beach's store 3 days earlier. In this context, he died because he broke the code of silence in his criminal fraternity. When the imprisoned brothers learned of Irvine Hodges' murder, one brother attempted to kill himself. This was presumably William, who may have been developmentally delayed, as his mother called him Tender, and he could not sign his name. June 29th, concerning Irvine Hodges, Brigham Young was quoted as saying, from